You're listening to the Food Talk Show on channelradio.co.uk. It's the Food Talk Show on channelradio.co.uk with me, Paul Andrews, and the lovely Sue Nelson. Hello, Sue. How are you?
Hello. I was hoping it would be a lovely, lovely sunny day because we're at the end of June. You would expect it to be, wouldn't you? We've got July tomorrow. But no, it's raining here.
It's wet. It's horrible. Okay. It's disgusting out there. And you're going on holiday.
I'm going to have to because actually...
I'm going to have to
because I had to put the central heating on yesterday. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. It was like a December morning. So I've had to put my heating on.
So, like most of us, rather than put the heating on, you go somewhere warm instead.
Yeah.
It's all right for summer, isn't it?
Yes, I'm off to Portugal on Saturday because I'm a bit disappointed with the English weather.
Mm.
Bearing in mind it was the end of June, we thought, no, the weather's bound to clear up. And therefore, nice weather, you're talking about ice cream. You've got to have ice cream in beautiful weather. So we're going to taste ice cream. We're going to pretend it's sunny outside. We're going to taste some amazing ice cream from Morelli's.
Do you know what? You can force me to eat ice cream even if it was snowing, to be honest. If I'm really honest about this.
Yeah, but it has a connotation. And I've got a really soft spot for Morelli's because I used to eat Morelli's ice cream when I was a child on holiday.
When was that, Kent?
It was, I can't remember. I have to admit it was in the 1960s. So things are very, very, very different then. We've also, on the sort of summary theme, we've got our We Hate Heston as a bit of Spanish omelette, you know, tortilla, because I always think of that as quite summary as well.
Absolutely. It's interesting. I don't know, just as a throwaway line, I actually make my own tortillas with that. But you also get a Spanish omelette, a frittata, which is a kind of thinner one, isn't it?
I don't really understand the difference between
frittata,
Spanish
omelette, tortilla. No, nor do I. That's why I was asking.
Spanish omelette, tortilla,
yeah.
And then just an omelette. I think it is the thickness, probably.
Yeah.
And then we've got
Tom.
Are
you talking about me?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. Then we've got Tom Kattner, who is a bit of a sort of digital wizard, a bit of an expert. And he's going to talk to us about the sort of rise of some of these food websites. And just he's got his finger on the pulse, really, of what's happening on some of these. So that's very interesting. He's going to talk us through something he's been working on called the Vita Mojo website. So that's going to be quite good. I'm going to tell you a little bit about ice cream to start with. We've got Bibi Morelli, who's from a very famous family, I think they are anyway. And they've been making ice cream for 5 generations. They got a trademark recipe and they introduced it into the UK. You might remember this, Paul, in 1907.
1907? I was busy that year.
So he and his young son, Mario, left home early in the morning. They had fresh ice cream, which is very different. I'm going to ask Bibi about this. Fresh ice cream is very different from the stuff you've had frozen for quite a while.
Yeah.
And he wasn't really allowed to come home until they sold it all, which obviously they used to.
Mm.
And the bicycle was replaced by a van, and then the business grew. And the first Morelli's ice cream parlour was opened on the seafront in Broadstairs, where they're still based, in 1932.
That's fantastic. Isn't that fantastic? I have to say, while you were going through that, I do like the bicycles, though. I do like the bicycles, and I want to ask Bibi when we talk to her whether they've got any bicycles back now.
You were talking about the butcher's bicycle last week.
About
so you got
what?
The butcher's bicycle.
I
last
was,
week.
Yeah. I got a bike fetish going on here. I don't know why.
You've got about a thing about it.
Yeah.
Anyway, they were the first to serve 20 flavours of ice cream.
Wow.
They upgraded their parlours. They expanded. They've got iconic stores all over the place. And now, of course, there's a nation network of ice cream and coffee bars around the UK. So quite interested to talk to Bibi about how do you expand from, you know, small one-off premises and make that work nationally is quite hard.
Absolutely.
Very, very exciting, though. In November 2003, they opened their first concession in Harrods. Very posh. So quite interested to know about that. And they're rolling out the concept. And again, quite interested to talk from a business perspective about franchising. You know, if you have got a great business idea, how do you do franchising and what
Absolutely.
Are the difficulties?
Yeah.
But they've now got parlours in Dubai, Bahrain, Manila, Kuala Lumpur, Kuwait, Dallas, and the world famous Casino Square in Monte Carlo.
Blimey.
doing brilliantly, aren't they? Absolutely brilliant.
It's interesting. I nearly said something stupid there, which wouldn't be unusual for me, obviously. But when you were reading that list, I thought, blimey, they're all in hot countries. But they would be, really, wouldn't they?
Yeah,
because
well spotted,
that's when
Paul.
When you like ice cream the most, isn't it?
Except for England.
Except for England, obviously. Yeah.
And we've done ice cream before on the programme, and we know it's sort of the ancient Greeks who had a sort of similar dessert to that in the 5th century BC. Hmm. I found out recently that there is now a hot dog flavour ice cream in Arizona.
Hot dog flavour.
Can you believe that?
Are you sure?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Hot dog flavour.
In Arizona.
What on earth would that taste like?
Hot dogs, obviously.
Can I have mustard on that?
I don't know. The most popular flavours are vanilla, chocolate, and then strawberry, in that order.
And it must have been that for a long, long time as well,
mustn't it?
Because they are the traditional flavours, really, aren't they?
And then my final little bit of facts before you pay your bit of cheesy tunage.
Yeah.
You know, you get that brain freeze. Do you get that sometimes when you have ice cream?
I get brain freeze all the time. I don't need ice cream, I'll tell you.
Actually, I was thinking that you get a lot of that on the show, don't you? Just people can't see it.
Yeah.
So when the sort of cold ice touches the roof of your mouth, it causes the blood vessels in your head to dilate. So when you're
Is that what made my hair drop out? Is that what you're trying to say?
So when you're in the show, Paul, and you've got brain freeze, it's because the blood vessels are dilating in your head.
Ah, that'll be it. Yeah. I'm glad I know that now.
That'll be it.
Yeah.
So before we talk to Bibby, who's looking quite summery, although she is folding her arms because I think she's shivering a little bit.
Yeah, it's cold in here. Sorry, it has to be, otherwise we get overheated.
Yes.
And that's just me, not the equipment.
Should we play your ridiculous tunage before we go into that?
Yeah, I've got some cheesy tunage. And as regular listeners will know, I normally try and pick some cheesy tunage to go with one of the guests on the show. And when I was researching this, I could have done something ultra cheesy, like the Cornetto song or something like
that's
that.
That's too obvious.
But that was just so obvious, it's unbelievable. And I came across this track, which I'd never heard before, and it's amazingly called The Ice Cream Song. But it's actually quite a nice track.
The Ice Cream Song.
Which was a bit disappointing for me, because I normally like really horrible tracks for this. Yeah.
Okay, so let's listen to that, shall we?
Yeah, shall we have a listen to it? It's The Ice Cream Song by The Dynamics. Let's have a listen.
Loving you was a whole lot of money, I'd be the richest man in all the land.
Oh, the ice cream song there. What did you think? It did mention ice cream in the first few opening bars.
And it's called the ice cream song, so entirely relevant.
It's fair enough, isn't it, don't you think?
Fair enough.
Good choice, do you reckon?
BB's very kindly brought some ice cream in. We're going to have to eat it pretty soonish because obviously it's melting a little bit.
Oh, what a shame.
Yes. So welcome, BB. It's really nice to see you. Thank you. I think I got some of your introduction wrong, didn't I? Sorry, the sort of national network. You ran some coffee shops to start with. Is that right?
What we did is, on the ice cream side, we have stores. We have our original store in Broadstairs, mm-hmm. that, as you mentioned, has been there since 1932. And we have a couple of stores in London. And then we looked at actually opening abroad, mostly because, as you've noticed, the weather in England is not that suitable to ice cream. The main part of our growth on the ice cream side has been international.
International, yes. That's interesting. I'm going to ask you about that later. Mm. Should we do some tasting before it completely melts into the mush?
If you're going to force me, yeah.
So just to describe what I've got, I have two lovely white sort of cool boxes here that are beautifully packaged with the Morelli's sort of purple.
I just tweeted out a picture of it. If any of the listeners want to see, if you look at my Twitter handle, Vanilla Web, you'll see a picture of the packaging. It's really well packaged.
All beautiful. With a ribbon. We've just opened it up and Tom, who's from Studio Graphene, who did the Vita Mojo website, is right in there. He's hold back there, Tom.
Yeah.
So we're going to try. We've got pistachio, hazelnut and coffee in one little thing. Any of those your favourites, Paul?
I'm a massive pistachio fan.
Yeah, I like pistachio.
I love pistachio.
And then in the other box, we've got strawberry, banana and chocolate.
What a blow. So
you ask a question, Paul, because it's really important.
Oh, I see. You want me to talk so that you can eat, and I was expecting you to talk so that I could eat.
You do carry on. Ask me a question.
Okay, well, while Sue is doing that, BB, I just wanted to mention something to you. Many, many years ago, I lived and worked in the United States on the East Coast, and I came across a Morelli's ice cream parlour while I was there. And so I wanted to ask you whether there are Morelli's around the world and your extended family out there and whether there are other kind of Morelli producers.
Well, there were seven Morelli brothers in the first generation that started making the ice cream. Mm. And I know that they sort of, you know, a couple of them went to far-flung places. So it's quite possible that one may have ended up in where you were. But yeah. I'm not aware of them. Okay. I don't know them as family members.
Okay, cool. Where did the original Morelli family hail from in Italy?
So just south of Rome, north of Naples.
Okay.
A little sort of village called San Andrea, which is near Monte Cassino.
Yeah, okay. Right, okay.
He stopped talking now, Bibi, because he started to...
I started eating. Sorry, I couldn't control myself.
Mm. Tom's just dug into the ice cream as well. Tom, I know you're a fan of coffee ice cream, aren't you?
Yeah, I drink a lot of coffee in London as well, so there's a lot of artisan coffee places around there, and the coffee was really, really good.
So the coffee ice cream is particularly good.
That's Kilimanjaro coffee.
What comes across in Morelli's ice cream, which is always done as a child for me, is it's particularly creamy, and it's the texture. Mm-hmm. Why is it different from other types of ice cream? It's almost like, I don't like using this, it's almost like Mr. Whippy ice cream, but it's proper natural stuff, proper old-fashioned recipe. Why has it got that slightly different texture?
Well, I would say, I mean, first of all, it's gelato as opposed to ice cream, which, you know, gelato just means frozen in Italian, but it's become its own sort of product category because it has quite different characteristics to ice cream.
Okay.
So, but I would say that the texture comes mostly from the fact that it's made fresh every day in every store that we have anywhere.
Okay. Seriously, fresh every day in every store. That is why it's so good.
So it doesn't get frozen hard like when you put ice cream in a deep freeze. When it's made, it gets put into the ice cream display and it gets served to you. So it retains that lovely texture. And we also have a wonderful base, and we use the highest quality ingredients that we can get our hands on. So I think that's the.
But I want to get back to eating, so I just need to get the question out there and then I can get back to eating. Without being overly technical, what's the difference between gelato and what other people call ice cream? Is there a major difference, one major thing?
Yep. I mean, I would say, you know, gelato is typically milk-based, not cream-based. Mm. So that's not to say that it doesn't contain cream, but it has a much higher proportion of milk to cream, while ice cream is more cream-based, which means that it's lower in fat. Which is also one of the reasons it doesn't freeze as hard. And fat coats the taste buds. So when you take a spoonful of gelato, you generally get a more intense flavor because you have a lower level of fat. And the other reason is we don't add air to gelato. So, you know, our percentage of air will typically be quite a lot lower than ice cream. So you're getting a denser sort of mix.
It's a different texture, isn't it, Paul? That strawberry is... Oh, that's so good.
Nah.
You don't want that. Can I have it back then?
No, you don't want it back. It's horrible. Mm. It's got a completely different taste to conventional ice cream. It's so it's got an intense flavour, but the consistency of it, the makeup of it, it just melts in your mouth. It's just not the same. You can instantly tell the difference between mass-produced ice cream and that. Basically,
you see, quite often you'll get ice creams that are very, very heavy with cream, proper cream. And that will have sometimes a little bit of that texture because it's so cream heavy, but it doesn't taste like that at all. It's very fatty. Mm. This isn't at all, is it? It's just absolutely gorgeous, really. It's just
I can tell just by tasting it. There is not a single calorie in that. There's no calories in that. I can eat all of that without any problem at all. I can tell that.
Yeah, I'm sure. And what's your particular favourite flavour, Bibi? I mean, I have to say...
She doesn't like
normally,
ice cream.
I don't normally like strawberry that much. That is very strawberry. I don't know what Tom's favourite is, but are you still on the coffee, Tom?
I've changed to strawberry.
Yeah, I have too.
It's a very intense flavour, the strawberry one, isn't it? It's lovely.
What's your favourite, Bibi?
I would say probably the hazelnut or the Venezuelan chocolate.
Venezuelan chocolate. Hold on a moment. She's holding some back, Sue.
Have you tasted that chocolate one yet, Paul?
I haven't had Venezuelan chocolate yet. No, I haven't.
That's very, very, very chocolatey. Very chocolatey.
It's gorgeous stuff. Absolutely gorgeous. Each of your stores make it fresh every day.
Yes.
So can you run us through how a day unfolds in a typical Morelli's ice cream store? Do you call them stores or parlours, or what do you call them?
Stores or parlours, yep. I mean, basically the ice cream maker gets in, the gelatiere, we call him. He's, you know, all our ice cream makers are trained gelatieres, which means in Italian ice cream chef. They get in earlier in the morning than everybody else, and they start making the ice cream. So it typically takes about 3 to 4 hours to make a full display. And once the display is up and running, we're typically open. You know, we have Kilimanjaro coffee, which is what we use to make our coffee ice cream. Okay. And we sell partly scoops and partly sundaes. So we're a little bit of an unusual, we're a bit of a hybrid in that we're sort of Italian because we make fresh gelato, but we also are a parlor, which is more of an American or an English sort of.
So it's a bit
style.
Like a bakery where the bakers come in really early in the morning,
exactly
4 o'clock in the morning, whatever, do everything. So when everybody walks through the shop, it's been prepared that day.
Exactly.
Yep. Wow. Well, I think you really can tell that, can't you, Paul?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to keep on that theme of a day in the life of a Morelli shop.
Okay.
Do you open all the year round, or do you tend to open only in the summer and spring?
No, we're open all year round. We sell our sundaes all year round, Knickerbocker Glories and Peach Melba's and Hot Fudge sundaes. And obviously we focus a little bit more on more wintry things in winter. You know, Irish coffees and affogatos, which are lovely hot coffees with ice cream swirled into them.
Sorry, I haven't heard of that before. Say again.
An affogato.
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 I want one.
Yeah, nice.
I want one. I want one.
Come
I want
to one. Those
yeah, absolutely.
And so, how did you go, or what would you
Excuse
recommend
me,
somebody
can
do?
Can someone come and take this away before I eat all of it?
It's lovely. It's so lovely. Yeah. How did you go from sort of, or what would you recommend to people listening in terms of going from one shop to going to another shop and actually really keeping that quality? It's quite hard, isn't it, to keep control once you start to expand.
Absolutely.
How have you managed that?
Well, I would say, first of all, you know, on the franchise side, partner selection. I think you need to ensure you have a really good partner who buys into your brand and your quality. Secondly, you know, obviously making the ice cream fresh every day means that, it, you know, and making sure there's recipe adherence. And making sure you have consistent quality ingredients across across all of your stores.
And if you've got a franchise, then you've got a recipe that you give them.
Yes.
So they have to use that recipe. So it's always consistent, whichever one of your shops you go to.
Correct. We have our own ingredients and our own recipes, and they.
So you supply the ingredients, we do. And that's how you really take control. And
exactly.
I'm guessing for if you're franchising, you're trying to take control of as many elements as you can.
Exactly.
So that they can't really go wrong. Really, if they've got all the great ingredients, you know, that they've got the sort of formula. Have you done? I know you've got loads of businesses, Paul. Have you?
I've never franchised any of my businesses, and I don't operate a franchise for anyone else. Many years ago, I worked as a management consultant, and I worked for big organisations that did franchise. Mm. You know, things like Pizza Hut and stuff like that. Mm. And with food franchises, it is just that there is a technique. Even McDonald's, you have a McDonald's University that teaches you to make a Big Mac in the Big Mac way, whether you're in Bhopal or Broadstairs or wherever you are, you have to do it with the same ingredients and the same recipe. Otherwise, there's no point in the franchise because people are going to a Morelli's shop because they expect Morelli's gelato.
Yeah, and it's got to be that. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter where that is. They expect it to taste the same.
Exactly. Mm.
And how has that affected you going abroad then? Because if you're trying to use the same recipe and obviously the same ingredients, I mean, you've opened up in Dubai and places like that. How do you manage an overseas franchise?
I mean, I would say, you know, in order to get that sort of, you know, a level of commercial scale, you do change slightly how you approach ingredients. In that, if you have, we use local seasonal ingredients, when we can, but our core ingredients, in order to have that consistent quality, in all of our stores, we have had to look for suppliers. So, for example, the strawberry ice cream that you've just tried, if you use fresh strawberries, they're wonderful 1 month, and then in another month they'll be sort of slightly sour, and in another month you might not get them at all, or they'll be imported from very far away. So what we have found, we had to look a lot to find somebody who did it, is a supplier who provides us with a fruit puree. So it's 100% strawberry puree. Has no sugar, is not pasteurized, has no colorants, no flavorings, no thickeners, nothing. It's 100% strawberries, but it's tetra-packed. It's in a sort of vacuum seal.
Yep.
So that is something that we can export, and we make that in every store you'll get exactly the same strawberry ice cream.
And presumably you can make that product, or they can make that product consistently by blending whatever they're going to have.
Exactly.
No, the
other thing I was quite interested in is it's a family business.
Yes.
I always wonder if that's quite a difficult thing or whether a really good thing. So you've got a whole lot of generations of people. I know you studied to be a lawyer, didn't you?
I was a lawyer.
You're not an ice cream
for my
mater.
Sins for 5 years.
You're a lawyer. So what? Were you always inevitably going to be in the business?
I never actually thought I was going to be in the ice cream business. Having grown up with ice cream, I always loved ice cream, and I, I've always said we make the best ice cream. I still think that today. But I worked for 5 years as a lawyer, and I was living in Milan at the time. And I think it was just the convergence of a few different things. I was looking to do my own business. I wanted to be more entrepreneurial and be my own boss. My father was looking to retire, and I loved the ice cream business. And living in Italy, I realized that obviously the gelato in Italy is wonderful, but I realized that how few places outside of Italy and Broadstairs had really good gelato. And
did you actually grow up in Broadstairs?
I did.
Lovely place. I like Broadstairs. So you say. I sort of moved from being a lawyer into the family business, but did people accept you? I mean,
I don't think my father had much choice.
He didn't. Okay.
No, he was wonderful. I mean, no, my family were. I think, at the end of the day, to lose something after five generations is a shame. So I feel that it's my responsibility to be able to hand it over to the sixth generation, and hopefully somebody in the sixth generation will take it forwards again.
Right. Okay.
Okay, well, I think it's really interesting. And there are lots of family businesses, aren't there, that get passed around. And, and you always wonder if you got, the awful son who's not very good at stuff that suddenly gets lumbered with a business who probably doesn't want to do it.
They typically don't go further than three. That's what
they
say.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Three or four. I think, one sort of builds it, the second one makes it a success, and then normally the third one loses it. So I'm trying very hard that one's not.
Better. Not do that. Yeah,
absolutely,
yeah.
Better not be you. That's
absolutely,
for sure.
Yeah.
And what's the most successful products for you? Is it the sort of Sunday side of what you're doing, or is it the particular ice creams that you're really known for and that really do well?
I mean, I think it varies slightly from store to store, but I mean, I do think the sundaes are a big part of what makes what we do quite unique. But I think in terms of sales, your scoop sales are always higher than anything else. Mm-hmm. And
absolutely. You've also got a slightly different model to most ice cream companies.
Yes.
Because you're basically selling through stores, are you not?
Yes.
Do you sell any wholesale at all?
We don't.
No. So you're selling your whole product, manufacturing it and selling it yourself, which is unique to a lot of industries, but specifically unique to this as well, because as far as I know, there are no larger, you know, there might be an occasional independent somewhere where they make it and sell it in their own store, but there's nothing on the scale of what you do. It's normally people making wholesale ice cream and pushing it out there.
Yeah. I mean, we've been tempted a few times to look at putting it into supermarkets, but, you know, and it's something we may still do, who knows, but fundamentally we feel it would change the nature of what is it that we do. We make, you know, people are more discerning, they're more health conscious than they ever were. I think that doesn't mean that you're never going to eat chocolate or bread or an ice cream, but when you do eat it, you want to have something that's really good quality, and hopefully that's where we fit in. You know, we make it fresh, we have great ingredients. If we start freezing it and making it long life and giving it sort of shelf life, I do feel we're changing what we do. That said, we may still produce something different to what's on the market in supermarkets at the moment. So it's tempting, but I'm not sure.
I've just been asked a strange question to ask you on Twitter.
Oh, God.
Sorry about it. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I'm not even sure. This might be even a wind-up. It says, could you ask BB if they use seaweed in the production of their ice cream?
We don't, but funny enough, we're about to with a gentleman who is also sort of based locally, who is famous for using seaweed in his products. We're about to try making a seaweed ice cream or seaweed sorbet that's been foraged locally.
Oh, really?
So we might make a seaweed flavor, but we don't use it.
Don't use seaweed or seaweed gum or anything? No, okay. Maybe he's heard a rumor that you're going to make seaweed ice cream. I don't know.
Exactly.
No, that's interesting. That's cool. Thank you.
I'm quite interested in some of these places that are doing quite well, like Itsu, for example, in London. And then they've started selling their products in supermarkets.
Yes.
So you're thinking, well, I actually don't understand the business proposition behind that, because, you know, you say, well, let's go out to Morelli's to get some ice cream. Oh, no, let's not bother. We've got some in the freezer.
And it's not as good.
So I'm not entirely sure that's a great business decision sometimes, depending on the nature of what you do.
Yeah, you just have so much greater reach. I mean, you're always limited otherwise to what's local.
Very good. Well, I love it. It brings back memories for me of being in Folkestone in the 1960s. I can't remember ever having the strawberry. I think I used to like the coffee one as a child, which is rather odd. But I think in the 60s there were quite a lot of Italian coffee shops then, and then it all sort of closed, and now, of course, coffee shops are back again. Mm. So I'm loving that. Are you, Paul?
I just ate it all.
Yes.
I just ate it while you were talking.
Big dent in that.
Absolutely.
So we're going to do a little bit of We Hate Heston, and for those of you who don't know, we call it We Hate Heston because we're sort of pretty sick of having all these kitchen, you know, cookery programs where you need 500 bits of kit and loads of space and takes you 4 hours to wash up afterwards. And we've been scouring to get the best recipes for people just to easily make something fantastic at home, because cooking isn't difficult if you get the right ingredients. So we've got Christy Ellis, our producer, and she does a really interesting thing. She makes Spanish omelette or tortilla or whatever you want to call it. And what she does is quite often she'll cook this and then she'll cut it up and the kids will take it for lunch to school, which is a great alternative to sandwiches,
absolutely,
of course, and a very good way of using up leftovers.
Mm.
So it might be something that you can manage, Paul.
I'm actually not bad at cooking the old tortillas, as it happens.
There you go. Yes. Perhaps you could bring some in for me to try next time.
Oh, yeah. Whenever you get back off holiday, I might well do that.
Thank you.
In the meantime, should we have a listen to
Christy?
To Christy and her omelette making.
Very good.
Hi, I'm here with Billy, my husband, and I'm going to make Spanish omelette or Spanish tortilla, which is one of my fail-safe dishes. And hopefully, Billy's going to learn a thing or two. So first of all, you need 6 eggs, a red pepper and a yellow pepper, and some chorizo. So I've got about 7 coin-sized pieces, pound coin thickness, that I've just chopped roughly into something resembling squares. Then I'm going to take my red pepper. So lots of preparation in this, first of all. So I'm just going to chop that up.
Take the seeds out.
Yep, take the seed. Thanks for that. Yep, take the seeds out. And just slice it and then dice it to the same kind of consistency as the chorizo. Now I've chopped the peppers and I've chopped the chorizo. I'm going to need to crack the eggs into a bowl. Now I need 6 of those. And I'm going to whisk those up. You also need for this recipe some new potatoes and boil them. And some spices as well, so or some herbs, should I say. So I've got here oregano, paprika, mixed herbs, and then your seasoning, salt and pepper. So I'm just going to whisk the eggs all together. There we go. Give it a bit more of a whisk, get some air into it. So obviously 6 eggs for an omelette sounds like quite a lot, but this is something that you have in slices. You can either have it with a salad, or sometimes my 2 children take it instead of sandwiches to school. Also need some onions, so about half an onion probably, and you need to chop that, same as you did the pepper and the chorizo, and a little bit of garlic, probably a clove. Okay, so I'm just going to put a couple of really good pinches of oregano into the egg mix. I really like the flavour, so if you want less, obviously you can put less, and it is purely to taste. I'm going to put some salt into the eggs. Good couple of grinds in there. And give it another good stir. And whilst I'm doing that, I'm just going to put the pan on. Now, you don't need a huge pan, despite the amount of eggs that you're using. You just need it to be reasonably deep, because it's quite a thick, stodgy omelette that you're making. So I put that on, and I'm going to put some oil into the pan, just enough to cover it, because I'm going to be using the chorizo in a second, and that's quite oily as well. So I've put the onions into the pan to gently fry them off, and I'm now adding the diced chorizo. I'm going to leave that for a second, just to let the oils come out of the chorizo and all that lovely paprika taste. Okay, so once you start to see the oil changing colour to red or like a pinky colour, that's when I add the red peppers and the orange peppers, because I like them to still remain a little tiny bit crunchy. Okay, that's looking good. The next thing that I need to do is add my potatoes. So they're drained out of the tin and they are just roughly chopped, and I just pop those into the pan at this point. So in the pan I've got the chorizo, the peppers, the softened fried onions, a little bit of garlic, and the potatoes. I've probably used about 7 or 8 roughly chopped new potatoes, just enough to cover the bottom of the pan. That probably takes about 3 or 4 minutes to get those to the point where you want to start putting your omelette mix in. And now I just spread the ingredients, make sure they're evenly across the bottom of the pan, and then I pour in the omelette mix. So you can hear that's all gone in. There we go. So what I'm doing with the spatula is just pulling down on the bits that are cooking like you would a normal omelette anyway, just to give it that thickness that you're looking for when you're making Spanish omelette. And you just continue to do that until it's starting to look a little bit more firm. It might be worth turning the hob down a little tiny bit at this point, just because you don't want it to burn. Okay, so what I'm doing is just every now and again I'm swishing the pan around to move the omelette mixture from the middle to the sides, and just squelching it down with the spatula to make sure it's evenly cooked. What happens is you can start to feel it cooking underneath in the texture, and definitely around the sides. So what you need to do next is to wait until it's pretty much cooked, but on the top, but still a little bit runny. And so you don't burn the bottom of the pan. What I do is put it under the grill. I have to watch it really carefully to make sure it doesn't burn, but it just helps it give it that final finishing push it needs to be cooked through, and also browns the top and makes it look more attractive. That's now been under the grill for a couple of minutes, and it's looking like it's nicely browned on top and all completely cooked through. So you can eat this straight away hot if you like, or you can leave it and have it cold. Like I was saying earlier on, I give it to my children in their pat lunches sometimes, and you take it to work too, don't you?
Yeah, it does. It's really nice.
Shall we have a little try then?
Go on, let's have a go.
Okay. So just slice through that. Okay. You can see that it's a lot thicker and a lot more filling as well with the potatoes. Than a normal omelette. So, do you want to have the honours first, Billy?
Not must.
Okay, go on then.
That's beautiful.
Nice.
Beautiful.
Let's have a go. Be rude not to, since I cooked it. Mmm, really nice. I have got quite a lot of oregano in that, but I just think it adds to it. Yeah, I really like that flavour. Probably takes about 15 to 17 minutes to make, all in all. And like I said, it's just my fail-safe dish. So thanks very much for holding the mic, Billy.
No worries, it's a winner.
Okay, bye-bye.
No worries, it's a winner, says Billy.
Yeah, do you get that? No worries.
No worries, it's a winner, says Billy.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is a winner, actually. It's a really good meal. And
you say, tortilla for you, yeah.
Take the kids, get the kids to take it to school for lunch. Very good, very good. Mm. I'm Tom's now wiped his mouth, with had ice cream all around the edge, and he's Tom Catner's now sitting here. He's the digital product manager at Studio Grapheme. And Studio Grapheme have developed the Vita Mojo website. And I know you've been on the website as
I've
well
I've been looking
today.
At it, yes, I have indeed. Yeah.
And it'd be really good to talk to Tom about the sort of burgeoning food tech sector in London. And also I'm hoping if we get time, he's going to give us a bit of advice that if you are a food business, how you should get onto the web and some of the tips that you should
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe just as a starter point, maybe if Tom could just tell us what, for those that don't know, what Vita Mojo is anyway, in terms of a business.
So Vita Mojo is a way of ordering your food. The concept was originally around lunch, but now it's moved into dinner as well. Mm. And ordering food that was good for you to cater to exactly what you wanted down to the amount of grams of a specific ingredient for that meal that you wanted.
Cool, got it.
So first, I've been on there. So first you choose your protein, Paul. So they've got chicken, meatballs, salmon, slow-cooked beef, eggs,
Anybody ever says that to me, it always takes me back to the same story. I was eating in a restaurant in Durban in South Africa, and the waitress said to me, I ordered a steak and something. She said, do you want starch and monkey glands with that?
You told us this last week.
I know, but every time you say it makes me think of it, because it was just so
starch
weird.
Starch and monkey glands. Well, they
starch
don't,
and monkey glands.
Funny enough, they don't have starch and monkey glands on the website here.
Did I not?
No, they've got chicken, meatball, salmon, slow cooked beef, stuff like that, really nice. Then you choose a side dish to go with it. So they might have things like kale salad, avocado mash looked really good when I was on there, broccoli, stuff like that. And then a sauce. So you might have, I know you like the spicy stuff. They have a spicy Thai sauce, for example, Paul, or vinaigrette or stuff like that. And what I really liked about the website that you've been working on, Tom, is that, as you said, you adjust the quantities of what you want with like a slider mechanism on the website, and it gives you the exact calorie, fat, protein, carbs, so you can balance the meal accordingly.
Absolutely. Brilliant.
So if you think I want less fat or I want more protein, then you can alter the balance of how they make up the meal. It's a pretty smart idea, isn't it?
It's a fabulous idea, and we were talking before the show, were we not, about this concept of more and more people no longer cooking their own food, and with something like this, it's another reason not to have to cook your own food. For someone like me that's perennially on a diet, it's so much easier to be able to go in and do exactly what you said, to make a portion of food that looks reasonable-ish with enough calories in it to keep me going, but not too many. And the ability to do that kind of thing is changing the landscape of how we are. And being an entrepreneurial persuasion, it made me think of things like, what's the value of having a kitchen in a place like London, which has a very severe space shortage? If you are crammed into a small space, maybe you don't need a kitchen any longer.
At all, yeah. So, Tom, I know you lived in Putney, didn't you, for a while? I think you just moved out. Was it Putney?
Yeah.
And you're sort of a young chap, well, compared to Paul. Did you use Vitamojo yourself as part of your sort of research and other types of companies like that who are cooking?
Yeah, we ate around a lot. So as part of the building of the product, there was a lot of research involved. I used Vitamojo. I also worked in the kitchen after we delivered the product as well. It was very much, the approach is called dog fooding, which in your...
Dog fooding. I don't like that very much.
Which is in the tips for people, but it's use your own service. So mystery shop yourself sort of thing. Yes, so right. If you have designed a service and the service is part of that is cooking the food and delivering the food, then it was my job to be there cooking the food to see what it was like and was the software and things like that working. Mm. So yeah, we ate around a lot, all sorts from Itsu to Wasabi to Byron Burger, all sorts of different places, and kind of got a feel for the different types of lunch offerings available.
Hold on. Why is he so thin?
I don't know. I was just thinking.
Why is he so thin? How's that happening?
I think he's taller than you, so that does help.
Oh, that'll be it.
Yeah. Those though, you go and there's a set menu and you can see it, you know, above. I think what's interesting with these, which I'm seeing in London quite a lot at the moment in food tech, is that people are being allowed to almost create their own dishes. Are you seeing that as a trend, Tom?
Definitely. Personalization across the... Well, personalization and the increase in transparency through technology has been something that's always going to keep pushing forwards. Mm. So the personalization, a lot of that angle came from the fact that people want their food to suit them. Mm. They don't want to be forced to buy food that is in the shop. And the idea is, like you said, you can customize it down to like the levels of protein, carbohydrates, and things like that. And the advantage of this going forwards, I guess, for people is that it gives them more control and it gives the consumer better control. So as the trends go forwards, it'll give people a better choice, but also not less choice, but it gives them the ability to control exactly what they want.
Yes. Absolutely. So instead of just getting a standard takeaway, you're making those choices within what they have. Is that what you're saying? And I guess if people have got food intolerances and stuff, it allows them to make up their own meal in a way.
Yeah. So you can enter into this product. You can enter your food intolerances, and it'll flag exactly which bits you can't have. So again, this is a problem for people who are intolerant, lactose or whatever
gluten or whatever, yeah.
Gluten, yeah. Another common one. And these things are getting more common as well.
Exactly, yeah.
But it'll show you. So you might really, really want a preset meal, but you can just take out the part of it that has your intolerance in it, and it still gives you the ability and the freedom to have the meal that you wanted to have in the first place. So that's an advantage.
So this place is based near St. Paul's Cathedral in London, and there's loads of different types of things like this. This is Vitamojo. So you go on the website that you've designed, and then presumably they order what they want. I guess they pay for it online. Is that right?
Yep.
Yep. And then it says it's ready within 15 minutes. So you turn up and then you pick it up. So you worked in the kitchens. How does that work? Is it chaos? I mean, how does the feed come through?
It was chaos at first.
Is there a big warning light that says, you know, hey chaps, we've got beef and broccoli coming, you know, get on with it? Yeah. How does it work technologically in the
so
kitchen?
So Vitamojo were really lucky. They had somebody join them from Chilango, and we worked closely with them. And it's a ticket system. So as you order, the food is only prepared a maximum of 15 minutes before you arrive in store. So it's really, really fresh, really freshly cooked. And also it reduces the waste because the only food that's prepared is the food that has been ordered. A ticket comes out of a receipt printer, and then it goes through the process of having the least affected by time parts added first, if that made sense.
Yeah, so get that.
You're adding like your sweet potato mash, things like that, cold rice, salad. And then as it goes through the process, then the meat's added finally, then sauce, and then it's packaged and left under a hot lamp.
So it's literally like a production line, almost like a factory.
Very similar, yes. So, I mean, there are other ways to customize your food, and Chilango is an example of that. And we kind of borrowed from that, borrowed a bit from McDonald's and their processes as well, where people have quite a specific job and their job is to do this. So
and be good at it.
Yeah, and be very, very good at it. And the accuracy as well is really spot on.
Yeah.
It's this fascinates me because it resonates with a number of things that I've talked about in terms of the death of big corporations and big mass-produced stuff, because technology, and it is technology that's the enabler here, has enabled us to get back to having more customizable, more local, more individual types of products. And seeing that in the food business is the epitome of that. And I guess
you get it for cars, don't you? I mean,
yeah, you do.
If you order a Mini, for example, you can have like 4,000 variations.
Absolutely.
And people are used to customising now, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess that's going into food.
Absolutely, and it's coming down to food, but it's also the customer interaction, and that's the bit that fascinates me, and I guess this is where Tom's coming from with Studio Graphene and what they're doing on the technology side, because what facilitates this, the big enabler of this, is the technology. It's the websites and the apps and the management of those systems, I guess.
Yeah, so if you go all the way back to management theory, it was Toyota who really came up with this in the first place, where they, because mass production was largely seen as the most efficient way to do things, and then Toyota came up with a different way of producing goods, and they said, if we don't mass produce things, if we just make sure we finish one thing at once, and then we finish the next one, then we finish the next one, it'll actually be more efficient. And all of the car manufacturers, and this is kind of dating back to the 60s and onwards, all the car manufacturers, well, some went bust in America because they were still mass producing and finding it very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, quality control is good as well. Can I just ask Bibi, just in terms of you and your, do you call them gelateriers?
No.
Gelateriers. In terms of them making ice cream, is there sort of like almost like a factory thing there, or do you just have people, you know, an expert who makes ice cream in one parlour and another one in another parlour?
That's exactly what we have. We have one in each parlour, and you know, many gelato brands or ice cream brands do have a centralised kitchen, and then they distribute from there.
Yeah.
Again, we don't like to do that because we feel it changes the texture.
Yeah.
But we do have an element of kind of bespoke, like you're saying, that you know, people can call up and say, you know, please can you make me a blueberry and condensed milk gelato, and we'll say yes, sure, because we have
Marmite. You told me off air.
Well, we've had all sorts of horrible things. So we've had all sorts of weird and wonderful flavors, but they can have a bespoke flavor, and because we have our own equipment, we're able to cater to that, and also to allergies and whatever.
And I think there's generations of people who are expecting some type of personalization, aren't they?
Yeah.
Tom, really, and that includes food. In terms of the Vita Mojo concept, the menu's been devised by a Michelin-trained chef, Paul Davis, and also a Formula One driver nutritionist, Helen.
Yes.
What was that? Was that to make sure that the whole balance of the meals, no matter what people do, are absolutely right?
Yeah, so it came from a few angles. There is in the future going to be a system, and it does exist, but it's in testing, where you can enter in your height, weight, and what your goal would like to be. And that's where Helen came into it quite a lot, and is how can the meals be suited to make sure, so you'd enter in your height, weight, what you're looking to achieve, whether weight loss, muscle gain, how much activity you do, and how many meals you eat a day. And it'll give you the meal.
I'd love to see Paul's printout on that one.
No, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. Oh, no, you wouldn't.
First of all, it might not go up that far in terms of the weight thing.
but so how it many does also ask for age.
Yeah, how many meals he has a day? I'd quite like to see that one. sorry to interrupt.
I'll
tell you what. I owned an Italian racing car. I owned a Dallara, and I fitted in that just fine.
That was quite a long time ago.
So the idea is that it was going to be a way of customising your food to you when information is quite hard to come by. So a lot of the technology in the back is focused around help making it easier for a normal person who doesn't have a F1 nutritionist to hand to get the food that they should be eating, basically.
And balance it in the right
balance
way.
And with the Michelin star chef, Paul, as well, it was making sure the food, because there aren't additives and it's not pre-prepared, so it requires a lot of, but it has to be consistent, it has to be good every day. There was a lot of work that went into how you can produce high quality food without additives, without preservatives, in a very short space of time. And that was where he came in a lot.
That's the starting point.
The starting point was amazing food, and it's how do we make this amazing food every day.
Yeah. And if we can talk about your skills, which are in this sort of digital arena, I think it's quite interesting that Domino's Pizzas, for example, had their first mobile phone order just 5 years ago.
I know, it's amazing.
Incredible,
isn't it?
Incredible. Since then, obviously, smartphones and tablets have completely transformed the market. Mm. How do you make a site compatible for both computers and phones? Because well over half of people are going online via their phone, aren't they, and not via a computer. And you've got to design it so that your website looks great on a phone as well as, you know, on a computer. How do you do that technically?
So in terms of the technique, there's I would always say design mobile first, and mobile first is a term that gets thrown around quite a lot. But if a company engages with an agency, which is usually the way, if a company doesn't have an in-house web team, they engage with an agency to do it. Like Food Talk Show, for example, has a fantastic website built by a brilliant agency.
Thank you. I like you a lot, Tom.
And you really have to be, I would say that if you engage an agency, the thing that's most important is to make your requirements very, very clear. Just very early on, be like, this has to be mobile first. Because if you design everything to be on a mobile phone, it's a much smaller screen and you're constrained to more, to putting less in, which will make it better in the end. The less you put in, probably the better it'll be.
And get that specification based on the user's point of view, not on what you like. So if you've got a target market, and we've got young people in London ordering food, you've got to have a site that they recognise and they respond to, haven't you? Not what you like. It's about what your customers like.
Yeah. So user-centric design again is something that's super important when people are looking to develop new web services or just marketing websites that are more static and designed to promote a business as opposed to carry out a specific function. But you have to think about your users. There's some great literature around, like, value proposition design is a good book, for example, where it talks you through a process of mapping out exactly who your customer is, because I think a lot of people, they're like, we want to build a website, okay, what we're going to put on it, but they haven't given a moment's thought to who's going on the website. And then if you know who's going on the website, it's why. Why is the killer question, like, why are they going to your website? The amount of 10 years ago, it was criminal, because the amount of high street stores that wouldn't have their opening, closing and location on their homepage, and that's why people were going to their shops. If you look now, 95% of high street stores do have their open, closing times and their address on the homepage, because that's the piece of, that's the real nugget of information.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And how do you test the user experience? So did you, in terms of this site, did you get somebody in and say, right, get on there, not going to tell you anything about it, and see how you use it? Because once you're really into your own thing and you're very passionate, sometimes you can lose the ability to, you know, be objective, can't you, as a client? So do you get people in to test sites for you before you launch them?
Yeah, so we use we'll use random testers, really, but also
you just drag them off the street.
Yeah.
Oi, you.
Yeah,
come here.
You try that. Yeah.
People we know, but like you said, it's important that they don't know anything about what you're doing. Mm. They should just know what their goal is. So if you are asking somebody to test something for you, to say, can you achieve this through this? So can you find the opening closing time? Can you order food? Can you do this? And if the person, you just say, oh, does this look nice? And you don't give that person a journey, you don't give that person a mission, then your testing won't be worth anywhere near as much. So make sure you give your tester a mission and say, can you complete it?
I mean, I know you've got internet businesses, haven't you, Paul?
I have indeed.
And the user experience is everything. And also, just trying to remember why your website's there. You know, what is it for? What you're trying to do?
Well, I wanted to ask Tom a question, and I want his view. With my own website, I have my own analytics, so I know the answer to the question I'm going to ask him from my point of view, but I have a completely different kind of product to what Tom is doing. From your viewpoint, Tom, do you see a difference between usage of native phone apps versus mobile-friendly websites?
A difference in how they're used, sorry?
Well, no, not so in uptake. Do people tend to prefer using a native app rather than using a browser on a phone?
Entirely depends on the cause for building it. It depends on the user. Because, for example, if you're going to build a mobile website for a shop, that's a good example where people are going there because they want information about the shop, or maybe they want to buy some clothes.
Yeah.
But if you're going to build a complex web service, such as a bank, there are technical limitations to what can be achieved on the web. So also, when you build an app, we get people who speak to us a lot from big businesses, and they say, we want an app. You know, why do you want an app? Because everyone's got
an app.
Because
everybody else has got one.
Yeah.
That's not a good premise for your app.
It's not a good reason, is it?
Yeah. But it depends what, like, your app has to pass a test. And that test is somebody downloading it and installing it. And then it has to pass the 3-second test of, oh, is this actually interesting? Is it what I wanted? Does it achieve anything? Does it add anything to my phone? It's the 5 or 6 apps on a normal person's phone are used, and the other 30, 40 that are installed generally are ignored.
He's been looking at my phone again, so.
Nobody wants to look at your phone.
No, that's true.
I think it's very interesting. The great thing, though, is that you can update stuff very, very quickly. You know, in the days where people used to post menus through your letterbox, you know, which would be in your drawer for like 2 years, is just well past, because it does allow you to update things almost daily if you wanted to, in terms of, you know, a new menu, a new flavour, whatever. So definitely making sure, if you're a food business, that you're online and people know what you're doing is really important. And we really feel we're on a bit of a crusade, aren't we, Paul, I think, to try and get food businesses to really think about the web, because you're going to have to be on there if you really want to get beyond the one shop sort of stage. Mm.
Yeah, so local findability and stuff, there are just a few things that a lot of people don't know. So Google will look for you, but you can submit yourself directly to Google and say, hey, I'm here. Come and look at me. Mm-hmm. But there's also Google Places, which is really important to submit yourself specifically, and then they will post you a letter. And that's how, if you look up a local Argos store and it'll say the opening, closing time, the phone number and stuff in that little box on the right-hand side, you get to that by applying to Google Places. They post your letters to verify that you're real. So if you're a local restaurant or ice cream parlor or something else, and it's local footfall that's really, really important to you, these simple steps like that are so crucial to letting people know, in terms of locality, that you are there.
And it doesn't cost anything.
It's completely free.
Great.
I think Tom nailed it. He absolutely nailed it earlier when he said, you got to know why you're doing this. And we went through a whole phase of people going, well, I've got a website and I've got an app. Why? Because that's what you do. Without thinking about the ramifications of all of those things, as Tom said, it's a symbiotic thing. If you have a physical store that requires physical people in it, you need to portray it in such a way that will attract physical people to it. If you're doing something online, it's a completely different issue and set of methods, isn't it?
You've got a final tweet here. Have you seen this, Paul?
No, I haven't.
From Denise Wilton.
No, go on.
Do you know Denise? She's saying, all the Morelli's ice cream's going down very well in their offices just now.
Ah, okay.
Even though it's not very good sunshine, obviously. So that's going well.
Nice one. I just want to ask Tom, we've only got a couple of seconds left, actually. So I just want to ask Tom just to give us a quick overview of Studio Graphene. He's actually the company he actually works for. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that very quickly.
Because he obviously knows what he's doing, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Sort of. So we are an agency. So we're a company that somebody might employ to and then instruct us about what they would like to do.
Yeah.
Predominantly, we don't work on marketing websites as such. We work on products such as Vitamojo, where we're like working through a whole, like we have this idea for a business. Yeah. Now we need technology to back up our idea. And so that's really what we do.
You very much work in partnership with them all the way through.
Yeah. So we stay until the point where they would hire their own in-house technical team, which is generally if these companies are technology based, such as like Vitamojo is, or you spoke to Sophie from Stop My Craving, for example.
Yeah.
Yes. Technology based companies eventually will need to get their own team of experts. Yeah. But we're there to get you to that point.
Okay, cool.
And seeing through that. And I think mystery shopping is another point you made earlier. It doesn't matter what your business is, you need to mystery shop yourself.
Absolutely.
Not just mystery shop, as in shopping physically, but shop as in go and be a chef. Go and be a person making the ice cream.
Try being on the other end of it. Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Well, that's fascinating. That's really, really helpful. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed speaking to Tom Kattner of Studio Graphene.
Yeah.
Learned some good stuff.
Absolutely. It's been a fascinating show right the way through.
And go on to Vitamojo website, even if you're not within shouting distance of St Paul's Cathedral, because it's an interesting concept and that's going to continue. And of course, well, what can I say about the ice cream, Paul?
We're just going to go and finish it off.
I was going to say, we put it outside, but I think some people in the office might have stolen some, so we may need to hurry out there. Again, my favourite, strawberry. Definitely strawberry. So thank
pistachio
you
for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for Bibi Morelli and her lovely family for bringing us that.
Absolutely. So that brings us to the end of another show, Sue.
It does.
I think we're there.
Spanish omelette, ice cream and a bit of ordering your food online. That's
cool.
It, really.
Yeah, thank you for listening to the Food Talk Show here on channelradio.co.uk. We will be back with you next week with another show from our Ashford studios. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.